Okay, it's on the bills, we're going to do this one.
Good morning, colleagues. Welcome to you and to the audience to our Wednesday, February 27, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today we're going to start with a few work sessions on the career school bills that we heard at the beginning of week two. There were, I think, seven of them in all, and three of them are ready to go. So why don't we start with that? Rep. Huffman, why don't you give me a... Well, no, let me, I'm sorry. Let me... Okay. Rep. Huffman, send it easy, please.
Aye, Captain.
Open a work session on House Bill 2185. Let me call up three people. Kimberly Johnson, would you come up, please? And Matt Barber and Jessica Adamson. Colleagues, as I think I told you in an email yesterday, the parties who have an interest in the governance of career schools have been meeting to look at these seven bills, I believe, are reaching consensus on them, and wanted to have a chance before we vote on them to hear from them. Kimberly, you want to start off?
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Demereau and House Committee members. My name is Kimberly Johnson, and I am the director as well as partner in a Beta Institute Portland. We are a cosmetology school in Portland, Oregon, operating the last 5 years and graduating over 500 graduates and employing over 60 employees. I thank you for allowing me the time to speak on behalf of career schools and the impact that they make on the education and workforce community in Oregon. On the workforce alone, the cosmetology field has over 57,000 licensures and 7,300 independent contractors. I also serve as the Director of Business Development for Dosha Salon Spa, which operates 5 salons in the Portland metropolitan area, and in 2012, we grossed over $9 million in sales last year, of which actually 4.8 was in employee payroll. So that's a very good thing on the workforce side of it. With the 224 career schools that PCS oversees, we employ together 3,500 instructors and 900 administrative staff members, and then over 71,000 licensures altogether. But why are career schools, I feel, important to the Oregon education community? First, I think they're going to play an integral role in the middle 40-40-20, as 25% needs to come from certificate or post-secondary credential. Second, I do believe career schools are looking to that quality our education, and actually PCS plays an integral role in that piece in assisting us with development of curriculum standardization, much of that is going on, as well as licensure, really ensuring the initial application is up to par, as well as maintaining that throughout. And then also, PCS has really served for career schools a great support in fielding many calls on that curriculum development side. Also, in regards to PCS and career schools, many of us are actually accredited and Title IV eligible. And when we are, as all of you know, GE has hit that field fast and furious in the last 2 years. And many changes, many questions are out there still going on. And having PCS stand strong and be an integral part to us in helping us through this process is a key thing, I believe, in our Oregon education community when it comes to career schools. So I just wanted to thank you for the time, let you know a little bit about ourselves and what PCS has done for us.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. But before we go on, so the bill immediately at hand is a fee bill that is asking the career schools to allow their fees to be raised. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments about that?
I do, and it's quite funny. As being a owner, it's very odd to ask to raise my own fee. And I did have to look hard, and actually when I went through this of why PCS was important, I actually said it's more important for that quality to stand and remain. And so I want to have a body that is actually looking out for that and ensuring that happens amongst all our schools. And so I agree and believe that we should raise those fees.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica, you want to follow on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. And we're here to also testify in support of House Bill 2185, which is the fee bill. We believe that this bill is important to ensure the health of this agency. From the private sector perspective, we believe it's critical that this agency has the adequate resources necessary to not only fairly enforce the regulations that are there for them to enforce, but also to make timely decisions. Their backlog impedes our ability to be able to provide employers the kinds of programs that they need to have trained workers capable of meeting the challenges that their customers are asking for.
Jesse, if I could hold you just for a second. Representative, you had a question?
No, I'm sorry, she could complete.
Okay.
Okay. So from our perspective, this is an agency that hasn't raised its fees in a long time. We appreciate that. We appreciate the partnership we have with this agency. But for us, it's critical that this agency is fully functioning so that we're able to get our programs approved and start the kinds of programs that are necessary that employers are asking us to get up and going and get students trained and ready for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jessica. Representative.
Thank you. It's Martin, right?
Oh, Matt.
Matt, I'm sorry, Matt.
Okay, Matt, why don't you introduce yourself for the record?
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Matthew Barber. I am a compliance specialist and team lead of the Private Career Schools Licensing Unit at the Oregon Department of Education.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Matt provided me an answer. If you remember, I brought up the fact that we had the hearing on this. I have a bill in that's taken away all fee increases away from agencies, including the Board of Education. That's a legislative responsibility. You provided me, and I appreciate your letter you provided me. I'll still be a no on this bill unless we can change it and take that part of the bill out, that future fee increases will be done by the State Board of Education.
Thanks, Representative. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would, since we've got Jessica up here, I would be interested in your opinion on that, the branches of government and fees and this particular case, if you've got one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I am, and the career schools fully appreciate the separation of the branches of government. We very much appreciate the legislative branch of government. We enjoy being here in front of this fine committee, and particularly the representative that asked the question. We are happy to come here and have this conversation or work with Mr. Barber and his department and have this conversation. Basically, sir, we are happy to have conversations all day long.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Not an answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, we get very good at that in higher education.
Any further questions?
Well, Mr.
Yes,
will they be available to answer questions about subsequent bills we're voting on today as well?
Yeah. Why don't we just keep you there, and if you don't mind, and then as we open each bill, let's do that if that's kosher. Okay. Any further discussion of this bill, this fee bill? Okay. Seeing none, Cassie, would you call the roll?
We haven't had the motion yet.
Oh no, that's right. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm pondering, Mr. Chair, whether I should.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Was Representative Wisnett asking for a possible amendment? Did I misunderstand that? Could we discuss that?
I said I'm okay with the bill minus that part of it, the fee increase, but. I'm going against my own self saying I'm approving Board of Education when I have a policy bill in to take that away from state agencies.
It sounds to me as if Representative is seeking a more sweeping solution to the problem in another area to the issue.
So.
It's the rule. It's by rule.
Mr. Chair, because I'm very much in agreement with Rep. Wisnett on that aspect of this bill and others relinquishing some authority.
And colleagues, let me remind you that this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means where, you know, I think those issues probably are going to be debated. You know, our role here is to look at the, you know, the fee and whether or not, you know, it's
the fee can go
a necessary thing and, it, you know, that it has support of the stakeholders.
Okay, Mr. Chair, you ready for a motion? I will go ahead and do the motion, but I may deal with this down the road. Chair Dembrough, I move House Bill 2185, to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Rep. Huffman moves House Bill 2185 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Yes, Rep. Dillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure, I think what I understand here, and I do appreciate those that are testifying from your perspective, from your schools, the way you're going to be affected, and you approve of, and you make a very good case for approving the fee. Question is, should we approve the fee increase, which I think is appropriate to the legislative body, and determine, give the State Board of Education the power to determine future fee increases? And I think that's where I get off the bill. If there's somebody else has a comment, but I just want to be clear of my objection. That's my part of the objection. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, would there be a chance we could put a sunset into this bill at some point that the department would have to come back for reauthorization of future the ability to continue to do this beyond a date that isn't in the bill as a way of alleviating concern about unbridled authority to the department?
Tell you what, colleagues, why don't we stand down for a sec? Okay, we're back in session. Yes, Rick Greenman.
We're back in discussion?
We are, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that the question of the larger question is an independent discussion to have, and either we will pass a statute that removes the fee-setting power or not. But the real question in this bill, it seems to me, is given the current situation, does this make sense? This would automatically be changed by a statute that...
an amendment, I didn't.
Yeah, and I think what Representative Musina would like to happen. And it seems, in the meantime, appropriate to vote on this bill as a specific issue under the current rules. And I would urge us to do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rick Corson.
I appreciate what Rep. Greenwood just said. But it does seem like we're saying that is okay. I mean, and the question really is going to be, is that okay? And I don't know. I'm a little conflicted about voting for something that says it's okay when I may not agree with it.
Okay, yes. I think at this point, what I would prefer is that we go ahead and pass the bill. That's what I would urge you to vote yes for the bill. And I and the vice chairs will communicate to Ways and Means that there is concern about that aspect of the bill and ask them to address it. So I think it would be most appropriate for us to just move this down there. Okay. So any further discussion? Rep. Greenman.
Yes, sir. I can vote for your... I can vote for the bill, but I don't think policy ought to be considered in Ways and Means.
You tell me to vote, no.
I
repeat.
Ways and Means always fights to deal with policy, but I think they depend on us to deal with policy. And in this case, I think this ought to be a policy bill, and we ought to be voting on it, on its policy. And they ought to be voting on the financial pieces of this. So I don't subscribe to telling Ways and Means to get involved in the policy on this bill. But I do favor moving the bill to Ways and Means. And they'll do what they want with it.
Yeah, I believe that they'll do what they want with it. You know, within the certainly they will do what they want with it. But I think within the context of the larger questions that Rep. Wisnant is asking, which I assume will apply to other bills that they'll be facing.
If this, Mr. Chair, if this clause is in there, yes, sir. But again, I can support the fee increase, although it's really high and it's going to be passed on. I understand that. I apologize. I should have probably had an amendment for the chair to look at, but.
I would have appreciated that. Thank you, Rep. Wisnant.
Can we continue to see if we can get one for Friday?
Can we just... No, I think we have to vote on it. And I would prefer that we just move this on. So, Cassie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Mangos. Aye.
Representative
Gilliam.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative Greenland?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Yes, sir.
No.
Representative Wisnant?
No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Yes.
Chair Dumbro?
Aye. The motion passes. And colleagues, let me just remind you what I'm seeking, colleagues, what I'm seeking to do as far as work sessions and amendments goes is my request is that amendments come to me 48 hours in advance, and then I will get them to all of the reps 24 hours in advance. So with some explanation, so we'll have a chance to really deliberate on the bills, and we won't find ourselves in this kind of situation. Okay. All right, so with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2185, and I'll open the work session on House Bill 2188. Victoria, could you remind us what this one is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2188 allows the Superintendent of Public Instruction to retain reasonable costs related to investigation and assessment of career school civil penalties, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Okay. Our witnesses, any of you have any comments that you'd like to make on this? Jessica, thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Jessica Adamson on behalf of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We just wanted to register our support for this bill to us. This just makes common sense to allow the agency, when they incur costs investigating or penalizing one of our schools, to be able to retain those costs within the agency so they can reapply them to continuing to do that important work. We believe this is a very simple measure and makes complete sense to us, and we just want to register our support. Thank you.
Okay, colleagues. Well, why don't we have a motion, Rep. Huffman?
Chair Denbrough, I move House Bill 2188 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Rep. Huffman has moved House Bill 2188 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure one of you have a good answer for me, but I'm a little confused about the dynamic that the bill plays out. Of the intro refers to the superintendent of public instruction, and he'll retain reasonable costs. I know who that individual is. I get that. Further down in the bill, it talks about the superintendent may retain reasonable costs related to the investigation. Okay, I think we're still talking about the same individual. And if you get to the last page of the bill, it says the commission may retain reasonable costs related to the investigation. So we go from the superintendent to the commission. How do they work together? How do we know they're on the same page? And how are we going to define reasonable? What's the process in place for that?
Matt, maybe you can answer that.
Chair Dumbo, Representative Johnson, the reason there is a change in references in the first part of the bill to the superintendent and then to the commission is that because on July 1st, 2013, responsibility for the career schools licensing program will transfer from the Department of Education, which is overseen by the superintendent, to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So what Legislative Council has done is they have prepared the bill, done the double amendment, so that it addresses both the situation of where the career schools program is now with the superintendent at the Department of Education and then after July 1st, 2013, when it transfers to the commission. So that makes clear that the authority that is given to the superintendent will transfer over to the commission.
So you're saying there's a present tense and a future tense
review
here. Yes. What's the process for determining what's reasonable?
Chair Denver, Representative Johnson, what we're looking for in the bill is that in prior investigations, especially those that have involved the use of a lot of agency resources, we have had to pay out substantial attorney bills to the Department of Justice. We have had to hire experts, in one case, a forensic accountant. It also helps cover staff time that is spent conducting investigations, site visits, reviewing voluminous documents. So those are the reasonable expenses we're looking to cover.
Is there such a thing as an unreasonable cost?
Chair Dunbar, Representative Johnson, I am sure there are examples of unreasonable expenses, but we're not an unreasonable agency, and we would only be looking to cover reasonable expenses related to an investigation. This would be limited to covering costs related to an investigation that resulted in the imposition of civil penalties. So there is that limitation in there.
Yeah. Matt, you're speaking to sort of normal and expected expenses.
Correct.
Those that are normally incurred by oversight agencies.
Yes, Chair Dunbar, and that was what I was getting at with the example of attorney fees to the Department of Justice, hiring the occasional expert in case we need to dig through complex financial documents, conducting site visits to further an investigation. Those are all reasonable expenses tied into the process.
Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough. Matt, good job of getting on the record that the reasonableness of everything. In the discussion of this, can you tell me why? Because what you described just now is recouping costs, not retaining reasonable costs, in my opinion. Some people might think it's semantics or a play on words, but I don't. I would think that recoup would have fit better in there. So I'm sure you guys discussed the difference between those and why reasonable retain reasonable costs was opted for rather than recoup costs.
Chair Dunbar, Representative Huffman, I was not involved in those conversations with Legislative Council, so I'm not exactly sure why they used retain rather than recoup. But typically what happens when civil penalties are imposed, that those penalties go into the general fund unless they're otherwise dedicated. So this is allowing us to retain from the civil penalties we impose those costs that we expended. So perhaps, but then again, I might be questioning the Legislative Council.
Yes, you can follow up. And I think I do see the distinction, but go ahead.
So LC used the term retain reasonable. It was their option to do that.
Chair Dembo, Representative Huffman, that is my understanding. That could be incorrect, but that is my understanding.
Right. The difference that I would see, if I can follow on that, between recoup and retain is recoup the cost would suggest that you set the level of the fine, you know, to cover your costs, you know, the costs of the oversight, whereas it sounds as if that's not exactly what happens, that there is a penalty schedule or something like that, and from that pot of money, then money will be kept to in order to cover the expenses. So it's a little bit different, I think.
And Chair Dembo, you are correct. The civil penalty schedule, we do have one in statute in Chapter 345. So we are kind of limited into what we can assess as a civil penalty based on statute. So that's why, that may be why they chose retain rather than recoup.
Rip Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have never been on Ways and Means and likely never will be, some would say for good reason. But I have to say that I am not a fan of saying, well, we got a subsequent Ways and Means, they're going to do what they want. I think it further denigrates the importance of policy committees. And in this case, I don't remember, and I'd be happy to be reminded, I don't remember testimony about a precedent of other departments retaining assessed penalty fees instead of it going to the general fund, a concept I'm not necessarily opposed to, but I don't recall that. Is there anyone, and I'm particularly speaking to you, Mr. Chair, with your experience, is there a precedent for doing this with other departments, whether education or others in the government?
I believe so. I was on the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, which oversees a lot of licensing agencies, and most of which have nothing at all to do with education, by the way. I believe that this is pretty normal practice. I don't know. Can any of you speak to that? If not, I know Cindy Hunt's back there, and she can.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, personally, I am not aware, but then again, I am not as familiar with the laws that are overseen by other state agencies. But again, as you mentioned, Cindy is in the back there, and she might have more familiarity.
Sorry, Cindy. Can you please come up?
Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. I was sitting back there trying to think of specific examples, and none are coming to mind, although I believe there are other examples where if an agency is doing an investigation, they can retain reasonable costs. But unfortunately, I don't have an example off the top of my head to give you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the bill was first presented to us 2 years ago, when we first went through this, I remember that point being made. That this was, this was typical of other, similar agencies, and Victoria tells me that is normal practice for the Department of Justice in their oversight of charitable entities. So I think it's not unusual.
Chair Dembo, thank you for that cue. Yes, the Oregon Department of Justice, I happen to know firsthand, that when they, for example, file a lawsuit or a complaint against an individual, one of the things that they are seeking is reasonable attorney's fees and costs. And so if they are successful in the lawsuit and, get dollars from, the defendant, they retain and, pay back attorney's fees and sometimes agency costs as well. So that's definitely, in that venue at least, similar to what we're seeking here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is helpful. I'm wondering, sitting here, if there isn't a WISNET approach to this bill as well, rather than piecemeal. But that's just an outlier thought.
Okay, great. I'm sure you have some priority bills pocket there.
Thank you. Several.
Yes, sir, Johnson.
Just further clarification, maybe it came out earlier, but the retainage comes from the actual penalty that's levied. Is that correct?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson, that's correct. Because as Matt was talking about, there's civil penalties by statute, and there's certain amounts for certain offenses.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, the total amount. And so we're not looking to retain the entire civil penalty. That goes to the general fund. We're looking to retain the part that's associated with reasonable costs.
And as I read the bill, it says a civil penalty may not exceed $500 per violation. Is that the number that's in play here? Be in section one.
Oh, yes. Yes, correct, but there can be multiple civil penalties depending on the number of violations. And so that's why we paused a little bit, because often it's a lot more than $500, because as you can appreciate, some of these schools, once we're to the point of investigating and pulling in forensic accountants, there's probably multiple violations.
Yeah, yes, sir, of course. Sir.
So with the monies that are requested to be diverted for particular issues, does that lower than the overall fund request for your agency? In other words, there's operational funds, right? And so this is to offset some of the operational costs. Would that lower your budget request?
Yeah. Chair Denbrough, Representative Gorsuch, while the Department of Education does get a significant amount of funds that are general funds, the private career school unit does not operate based with general funds. It's totally fee-based. And so, you know, when we do an investigation, for example, that's coming out of the fees that other schools pay. And so when you talk about if we were to retain these fees, you know, would that lower the general fund? It's not that the two are not connected in this unit, because the unit's separate and operating under fees.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, so the money goes into the general fund, but it doesn't come back to the unit at any point.
Chair Denbrough, that's correct.
The it's money not goes, retained.
Right. Chair Denbrough, that's correct. The money goes into the general fund and then is allocated by Ways and Means. And I believe, you know, the rationale for that is to not give agencies an incentive, mm-hmm. if you will, to investigate folks and raise money. Just the theory on that. But yeah, it goes into the general fund and is allocated how Ways and Means sees fit.
Thank you. That's helpful. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, Cassie, would you call the roll on this one?
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hoffman?
Aye.
Chair Denbrough?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2188 passes. I will close the work session on House Bill 2188, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2189. So, Victoria, what is this one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2189 allows the State Board of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to adopt rules related to general governance and operation of career schools, allows rules adopted to be specific to individual professions provided by career schools, modifies statutory language related to training requirements for hair design, barbering, aesthetics, and nail technology, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Witnesses, any comments about this one? Ms. Adamson, you want to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jessica Adamson, Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We are here to share our perspective on this bill We appreciate what the department is getting at in this legislation, the portions of the bill that are technical corrections to nail and barbering and aesthetics are not of concern to our association, but the portion of the bill that addresses the broader rulemaking authority was initially of concern to us, as we understand through conversations with Mr. Barber and the department. This portion will be done collaboratively. Our concern today is that what this bill seeks to do is to provide more structure to programs that don't have a current licensing board, so for example, phlebotomy. We have schools that offer phlebotomy courses. They are approved today to offer those courses. Our concern, as we've discussed with Mr. Barber, is to engage in a process if we're going to set in place a regulatory structure for those schools to meet, to do it in a way that's collaborative to ensure that those schools, if they aren't meeting whatever standard the department is looking at, have an opportunity to get there, so that students who have gone through that program or in the middle of going through that program aren't all of a sudden in the lurch, not being able to finish their course of study or having their course of study not be useful to them, and to make sure that we're doing it in a way that doesn't upset the current apple cart, but meets the intention of the department, which we think in overall is good. So we look forward to being very active partners with the department in making this the implementation of the broad rulemaking authority effective and work. And just wanted to put that on the record as our understanding of the intention of this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Adamson. And Matt, the bill also includes a technical kind of language fix, doesn't it?
Chair Dembro, correct. Again, Matthew Barber, compliance specialist and team lead for the Private Curriculars Licensing Unit at the Oregon Department of Education. It does contain a housekeeping measure. About 3 years ago, the department adopted an instructional model for use by licensed career schools in Oregon. One of the elements of that instructional model is something called competencies, where students have to show what they're, that they have established a, or they have learned and mastered a skill that they have to do. Unfortunately, that's causing a little bit of confusion for some of our licensees because, at least in the cosmetology field, we can have proficient competency-based cosmetology schools. So we've already had at least one instance where a school has contacted us asserting that they were a competency school, even though they aren't, because they have adopted an instruction model that includes competencies. So we hope to clarify this confusion for our licensees by changing the term in statute from competency-based to proficiency-based, which is actually not only going to reduce confusion, but it's a more accurate description of the instruction that's provided.
And it's more the term that has larger use in the world of education today, I believe, proficiency-based. Right. Colleagues, yes. We're in questions of the witnesses phase, if you have
that's
any.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Can I?
Please.
Thank you. Will this language pointing out proficient, moving from competency-based, proficiency-based, have any effect on the total amount of hours required for the applicant, in i.e., if they can demonstrate that they have, acquired the skill, that they don't have to, for instance, spend 1,450 hours in hair design or something? Will allow them to move through the program more quickly, I guess, is my question.
Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, it won't have a change in that. This is simply a housekeeping measure to change the wordage so it's more accurate and avoids confusion with our instructional model. It's not going to have an effect on how much time it takes a student to progress through a program or to show that they are proficient in it.
Yes, Rip Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill takes effect if passed in July of this year. Would this affect folks who are already in programs? In other words, particularly the competency versus, it's not really versus, but enhanced by proficiency, or would it be new students going forward?
Chair Dembro, Representative Gum, it's not an enhancement. It's a technical fix to reduce confusion for our licensees and to make the language more accurate. So this isn't going to have an impact on students who are currently enrolled and progressing through what's presently called a competency-based program. If it is then changed to proficiency-based, that is not going to impact the student's program.
Good, thank you. One quick follow-up.
Yes. And so it just changes the wording in statute, essentially. Is that correct?
Correct, Chair Dembrough.
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up. Have you, Mr. Barber, declared your conflict of interest on this bill?
Here we go.
Just a reference to your name, I'm sorry. I withdraw.
Thank you.
You bear your name. You bear your name proudly and effectively, Mr. Barber.
Rep. Huffman.
Are you ready for a motion?
I believe I am.
May I make a comment first?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to some of the questioning, it is my plan as we progress in the session to bring up the topic of. Career colleges and maybe anybody else stopping, in my opinion, the bad practice of going retro on somebody that is already enrolled in the school, changing the rules in the middle of the stream and forcing the student to pay additional fees and stuff. I hope to bring that up in a hearing near you soon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Dembrough, I move House Bill 2189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Huffman moves House Bill 2189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Rick Greenlick.
You know, in the bill, after the change of style to go from may to shall, or may not, shall not, it points out that members of the Board of Education shall not have any financial interest in the career colleges, the career schools. Some of these are large public corporations, I think, is that right? I'm not sure I understand how that can be applied. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't a change, it's in the original statute. But maybe Cindy deal with this? I mean, I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure how.
Yeah, Matt can probably speak to this. But again, I want to point out that we're talking about career colleges here. We're not talking about, you know, the big for-profit colleges and universities that are generally in chains, multiple sites.
Is that correct? There are not, these are not publicly traded companies? I think they are.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Representative Greenlick, Mr. Barber could probably speak to this better than I could. I believe it depends on the school, what they're offering in this state, whether they're a certificate only or whether they offer both. Mr. Barber has referenced some entities that are licensed as career schools, their owner of which is actually a tax entity because they're doing tax preparation training. So whether there's a conflict there, whether somebody is part of their pension plan, owns a piece or a share of that stock, it's probably possible, but unlikely that they would know that they do or do not. So I think it's certainly our understanding, the intention of that is that you don't have somebody who is as an entity that owns or wholly owns a career school as a member of the State Board of Education. We understand that that's the regulator. It's very awkward to have somebody who is regulating everyone else. But it is possible.
Well, we have conflict of interest statutes that define a direct conflict of interest. And it would seem to me the language would be better to refer to that conflict of interest language that talks about direct pecuniary interest than this, which is a little, it seems to me, outdated. Although I definitely approve of the notion that you shouldn't be regulating something that your Aunt Matilda owns.
Yeah, and the Board of Ed does have to, follow our you know, the public reporting and ethics laws. So presumably they would be covered by that.
And Chair Dembrough, Representative Greenlick, it sounded, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it did sound like one of the things you were first addressing at the initial part of your question was why the switch from shall not to may not.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
Every 10 years they change from may to shall, and then 10 years later they change back from shall to may, so then they change every language and every...
All right.
No, I wasn't... I know why that's about. It was the original content that I... that triggered it.
Right. I see. Okay. Any further discussion of this bill? Okay, seeing none, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Gilliam? Aye. Representative Gorsuch? Yes. Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Woodman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Aye.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. The motion passes, and I will... Who wants to carry this to the floor? Do we have any brave volunteers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Wouldn't this be the consent calendar?
Yeah.
Let's not do that.
Mr. Chair, can I fall on my sword and I'll carry it?
Okay, Rep. Johnson will carry this bill.
Are we allowed to object to your assignment?
No. Okay, so with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2189. Thank you. Thank you very much, Kimberly, for coming down here, and Matt, of course. Colleagues, as I mentioned in my email, the parties are working on the remaining bills in this package. I hope to have this settled by the end of the week, and I'll get any amendments to you by then. So you'll have plenty of time to look them over and to offer further amendments if that's your intention. I'm planning to have the work sessions on those bills a week from today. So we'll have plenty of time.
I apologize. What are you referring to? Which bills are you referring
to? The others in that 2180 range.
Okay.
There were seven of them in all. Okay. Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Yeah, just another comment. As you recall, Mr. Chair, we had, I think, most of these bills in some form or fashion back in 2011.
Right.
And there was just some general angst with... how prepared they were and how together the concepts were and so forth. So if you can get those amendments to us as much as in advance so we can look at those, put those together, what was proposed, I think that would really help our process here. So appreciate that.
That is my commitment, always. Thank you, Rep. Johnson. Okay, so I am going to now, it's my pleasure to open an informational hearing on the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And I'd like to call up Betty Duvall, the chair of the HEC, and Neil Bryant, the vice chair. Colleagues, this is both part of our Higher Ed 101, to look at that piece of the puzzle that is the HEC, and also to hear from the chair and vice chair about a couple of the topics that we assigned them last session, specifically the one on textbook affordability, and the one on prior learning assessments. Again, let me say what a pleasure and honor it is to have the chair and the vice chair. The vice chair, I'm sure, is now really regretting that he ever left the legislature and wishes that he were back here. But he can speak to that for himself. So if you would introduce yourselves, please.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Dembrough. I'm Betty Duvall. I have the pleasure of chairing the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I am a Professor Emeritus of Education from Oregon State University, and prior to that I spent most of my career as a community college administrator.
Neil Bryant, I'm an attorney in Bend, practiced there for about 40 years, and I served in the Senate from 1993 to 2001, and I compliment you, Mr. Chair. I can't remember any Senate committee that had the entire committee show up at 8 in the morning.
Yeah, that's the Senate, please. Yes. Thank you.
Chair Dimro, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, it's a great honor to speak with you today. I want to begin by making a few general comments, and then we want to talk with you about the reports that you assigned us to prepare and what our findings are. 50 years ago, there was a turning point in higher education. Change happened that was beyond the thinking of anyone in higher education. 50 years ago, community colleges were formed. It was a new kind of college that no one had ever heard of before and had no notion what they would do. At the risk of sounding a little grandiose, we may be at such a turning point again now, 50 years later, because there are outstanding changes that are happening in higher education. Let me just list a few that we on the commission are looking at. First of all, of course, are MOOCs. We've all heard the stories, massive enrollment, on the web, available at any time, any place, delivered by big name universities. Everything we know about online study, it's more costly than cost saving. Many students lack the motivation to complete independent study. All that is now called into question. Moreover, at least in the beginning, no credit for the course was available. This was truly learning for learning's sake. The next item then becomes credit. Who needs it? Students enrolled in these courses with the knowledge that they would not earn credit toward a degree. It raises the question of how important credit and degrees are and will be in the future. Will employers be interested in what credits you have accumulated, in what degrees you have accumulated, or will they just be interested in whether or not you can do the job? There is, of course, always, anyone from higher education has to mention the question of revenue. Who pays for higher education? Increasingly, states don't. Increasingly, tuition has risen. Higher education people joke about we used to be a state-supported college, now we're a college in the state. As students incur the cost, it raises other questions. The question of debt and how much debt students can and should undertake. In addition to that, as you know, universities have always benefited from funding provided by grateful alumni that provided nice things like some scholarships, some physical facilities, some chimes for the quadrangle. Now community colleges are moving into that too. As tuition goes up, more scholarships are needed. To what extent then will higher education be dependent on that kind of private funding? Another item is tenured full-time faculty. In community colleges, it's not uncommon for probably two-thirds, maybe better, of the coursework to be delivered by part-time faculty. Universities increasingly are hiring non-tenured, one-year only kind of faculty. That may not really change what happens in the classroom, but it leaves undone all the other work of the academy that faculty generally do, governance, course development and review, and so on. And then there is a question of other costs that students face. Fees, depending on the program that you're in. Do you choose to study history as a major because you can't afford the fees that are associated with engineering as a major? Textbook costs, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. Technology may come to the rescue here a little bit. And again, we'll mention that later. Regional accreditation is a final item I want to mention. And the role of private institutions. They are other important parts of higher education in this state. And how they fit into the whole is an area that needs and deserves review. The list could go on. I haven't even mentioned sports, for example. And that makes this such a compelling time to consider all that we know and hold dear about higher education. How much will higher education change? Probably more than we think in some ways, and probably less than we think in some ways. I don't envision any ivy-covered walls crumbling. Students will probably do what they've always done, select an institution that they like, that offers the programs that they're interested in, and one that they can afford, one that meets their hopes and dreams. They'll shop before, during their education, and I expect increasingly we'll do what we see them doing now, choose one from column A and one from column B, putting together a program that suits their needs, delivered in a way that suits their needs. They'll take some regular courses. They'll take some web courses. There will be some requests for credit for non-traditional learning or experiential learning. They will stop in and they will stop out. They will get a degree or not. Higher education will not be something done in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or 8 years. And that may not be a bad thing, because it will become lifelong learning pursued throughout their career and beyond. Many of the new delivery systems will be add-ons to existing institutions and what they offer. And you have created a Higher Education Coordinating Commission to investigate these things, to bring together some of them, to weed through the growth and change, and to demonstrate the forward thinking that can help our Oregon communities and citizens learn and profit from this changing time. You've created a group that is, I'm sure Vice Chair Bryant would agree, is enthusiastic in their work, who bring great experience to their work, and who've entered into the tasks at hand with the joy that all of us bring to a new assignment. We are spending our time gathering information, asking people to come and talk with us so that we can broaden and deepen our understanding of higher education in Oregon. We are prepared to join with you and the governor in building on an existing higher education enterprise that's really second to none, and forging an even better one for the future. There were three tasks that you assigned to us to investigate. They were the Western Governors University, the cost of textbooks, and credit for prior learning. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Neil Bryant, now to talk about particularly the Western Governors University. Neil?
Thank you, Betty. Well, good morning. The HEC was formed July 1st, 2012, and all of us who were appointed knew a few things of what was expected of us. The three reports we'll talk about now, and then the remainder was kind of up in the air because we weren't sure how this newer commission and how the plan would evolve, and I understand that continues to be an evolution. But it was an unusual commission because it was created also without any money. And so there was no staff. We borrowed from higher ed, we borrowed from community colleges, and a little bit from the governor's staff to help us out. But the people signed on and agreed to do that, to fulfill those obligations without the funding. I co-chaired the work group dealing with Western Governors University, and I presume you're all familiar with that organization to some extent.
Mr. Bryan, don't assume that.
Okay.
Because this is actually, you know, probably two-thirds of the committee is new this session.
And yes. Do they have they received the actual report that the HEC produced?
If they have looked at the committee resources, then yes.
Okay. Well, let me talk about...
Which means probably not.
Western Governors University for a moment. It's accredited in all 50 states, so it's offering courses, and it has an actual presence in the state of Washington. And that was the one we were most interested in receiving testimony from. The president of Western Governors University in Washington came down and met with the committee and spoke to us. The legislature there put in $4 million, and Bill Gates put in $4 million to get it started. And it was designed to fill a niche for community colleges there, because the community college graduates couldn't get into the Washington universities. What do they do? It takes them a long time then to get their four-year degree, and it wasn't what the legislature wanted to see happen. So they promoted this, and it's been very successful in that state. We asked how it's affected the state universities there as far as their enrollment, and again, it's very new, so the research was preliminary, but not very much. The one that seemed to be impacted most was the University of Phoenix, which reported that their enrollment had dropped significantly since Western Governors University began. Online competency-based education. It's not a credit program that we're used to. You can start at any time, so it's convenient to the students. Any month you want to begin, you can. You can move along at your pace during that time. The cost is relatively inexpensive. You have a mentor in addition to a faculty member who puts together the curriculum. So other states that were involved in it actively were Wisconsin, Indiana, and one other, I think it was Texas. But the question that was posed to us by the legislation was, what should a partnership with Western Governors University look like for the state of Oregon? Wisconsin decided to create their own online brand and kind of follow Western's operation, but make it a Wisconsin higher education model. Indiana just embraced what Western Governors University said, here's where it is, and allows their students then to have access in Indiana to what would be our opportunity grant. Washington, I think, also is considering doing that in this next session. It created some controversy because naturally our colleges and universities, both private and public, were concerned, okay, what's the impact going to be if this takes off? But Oregon community colleges have already signed a memorandum of understanding with Western Governors University. And without any publicity or marketing, it last year had 722 people enrolled in the program and generally received high marks. The students enjoyed it, and it met their needs. And we heard testimony from some students and an employer saying that the certification, the accreditation, what was produced by Western Governors University, and it only offers three categories right now.
Four majors.
Four majors were met their employment needs. Eastern Oregon University is the leader in Oregon in online education. They've been doing it for years. 60% of their students take online courses in addition to what I call the standard on-campus courses. And Merrillhurst is very good on online courses. So my sense is Oregon universities are going to offer more of this. They were concerned. They didn't want Western Governors University to students to be at this point eligible for the opportunity grant. The committee felt, well, it's a fairly small grant already. It's over applied for. thinning the soup. And if you open it up to Western Governors University, should you also open it up to any student who takes an accredited course from wherever that university is? And that's a good question. And so we punted that back to you and didn't answer that question, but says you need to tell us what you think should be done. On the recommendations, we think you should continue the relationship with Western Governors and continue to monitor. As I said, it's continuing to grow quickly in Washington, and I think it'll grow with the Oregon Community College programs too, especially if they spend a little money in marketing and advertising that it's available. This web portal idea, where you can go online and look not only at Oregon colleges and universities and what they offer and what you need to get here, but also to add online courses that are approved by the Oregon degree authorization program, we think is a wonderful opportunity so that students who should drive this process can see, okay, this is what I want. I can go this way or I can go this way. Here's how long it would take me, and this is what the cost is going to be. And they're entitled to that type of information, so we really encourage the continued development of that portal. And online education is going to just continue to accelerate. And the committee felt this is the only way you're going to make 40-40-20 is to have these types of avenues. Mm-hmm. So what I see continuing to happen, you're going to have your standard education with on-campus, not as much in the way of online, although it's going to be offered online to students. You're going to have someone who is almost entirely online as a student. Then you're going to have a hybrid. And there's a lot of questions that get involved there that we couldn't answer. One is, what's the quality of the program then? And that needs to be answered. And what's the need? What's the gap analysis? Is Western Governors University and the other online courses, are they filling a need that Oregon has? Our impression is, yes, they are, because if it's, the need's not there, then the market's not there and the courses aren't taken. And if you're a for-profit Oregon college, you definitely got to make the market need, because you won't have students. So it's going to be market-driven. Students are smart, and they have trouble affording the higher education system we have now. But there needs to be an analysis, and that takes staff and money. I'm not sure how to do that, but Representative Greenland, from your experience in education, and the chairs could probably have some ideas of how that should proceed, but that's what we did.
Yeah. Let me stop you there, Mr. Bryant. And Rep. Gallegos, you had a question.
Yeah, Ms. Bryant, I'm not familiar with online education course offerings. Can you give me an example of how competency is assessed on an online course?
I can in general terms. Again, primarily with Western Governors University, you have a mentor and you have a curriculum, and the mentor can tell when you go online and how long you spend online doing what you're supposed to be doing. And then if you have questions, you can ask the mentor, but the mentor follows then what you're turning in for work, and then there's testing, and in some cases what I call certification of testing your competency and whether or not you should receive the degree from Western Governors University.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
What kind of monitoring is there? I mean, why can't somebody else go online and write papers or take exams?
Could they plagiarize their
exactly show? Yeah,
they have safeguards to try and defend that. And of course that also happens in our standard education situation too, but from what I understand, you'd have to hire someone to use your computer and your password and go online and do this work. And at some point with the mentor, you have a face-to-face conversation, whether it be over the phone or in person. And if you've been a fraud, I imagine it would show up in that case. But that's one of the questions. And of course, they want to be careful on that too, because they want to present quality programs that are accepted in the states. So they have programs to try to ferret that out, and I'm sure they're going to have to be on their toes, because it could be an industry on its side, and students are clever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, as Mr. Bryant says, this is not only a problem that Western governors faces. And, you know, I think anyone offering online courses has that challenge of making sure that the student, you know, who's doing the work is the student who's registered for the course. I think it's actually less of a problem with Western governors, since, you know, they're not, their relationship with their, you know, with the faculty is not just for one course. You know, it's a kind of, it's more of a long-term relationship. And so, you know, there's, I think, a better sense that they get to know each other, and, you know, the instructor stays on top of it, or the mentor, as they call it within this model. Rick Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I have for you in terms of this is, what's the issue related to transferring? So, for instance, let's say you went to a community college and then you finished your bachelor's at Western Governors. Will that be a problem then to transfer to a graduate school? Say you went to Portland State after that. Would those credits transfer over?
It depends on the graduate school you're going to. Ideally, yes, they would. And ideally, with the portal, you'd know in advance that if you did A, B, C, and D from both the community college and from Western, that it would meet the requirements to get into Portland State for their graduate school. Western Governors certainly feels that those students should be allowed. Every university is protective of their advanced degree, and there was discussion, okay, well, the engineering department or Oregon State's going to have to approve if they ever went and offered the preliminary engineering courses to make sure that it met their criteria. The transparency of knowing that in advance should be something that can be developed.
Mm-hmm. And really good. You know, University of Phoenix has run into some of these problems where people take classes there and they want to go to another school, and then they find out there's no articulation agreement. And in the community college system in the state of Oregon, we just don't normally experience that, because being in the state, we have that transfer capability. So I think it's really important, both for groups like University of Phoenix, but also for this group, to make it extremely clear to the students so that they don't end up taking a bunch of courses and then they can't transfer them to the place they want to take.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I should point out that Western Governors is accredited by the Northwest Regional Accrediting Association. That is the same body that accredits all the all the public colleges and universities here in the state, and most of the independent colleges as well. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you recall, we spent a fair amount of time discussing this. Was it the February session or the long session?
No, it was the February session, I think.
And had some excellent testimony from WGU as well as some students and so forth. So maybe at some point in time, you know, as we go through our Higher Ed 101, it would be, you know, to get a brief presentation just so the committee would understand. Because it is a vastly different concept. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the degree offerings, they're limited in what they offer. But as I recall, the amount you pay for the tuition doesn't just, I mean, you have access to as much information as you can glean within the period of time. So it's completely on a proficiency based. A student can ideally move through to degree completion much quicker than 4 years, because you can move at your own pace, and at the rate you can move, you can really accomplish quite a lot. So, Mr. Bryant, I thank you for your in-depth analysis of this. I'm thankful that the HEC took some time to look this over, but I agree with you all, I think, in what you're inferring here, is that as we pursue 40-40-20, we need an all-of-the-above type strategy, and I think that there is a place for WGU somewhere within the system here, as long as, again, we need to make sure that we're not compromising our other institutions with what they're offering, but perhaps we just don't need to have redundancies in the types of degrees that are offered. If WGU can handle this part over here, Eastern or whomever, the community colleges have the ability to do things differently and so forth, and You know, this isn't a one-size-fits-all world in terms of pursuing post-secondary education. You know, we're very diverse populations in society, and I think our offerings as a state need to have that in mind, too. So, again, I appreciate the HEC and what you've done thus far, and hope we can continue to monitor what happens in other states. I think that's very valuable, too, to look at the pluses and minuses with how WGU interacts with Washington or other states and their ongoing existing higher ed systems as well. So appreciate your recommendation.
Thank you.
Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, Senator Bryan, I'll find time to talk to you. I have a lot of questions for you and other things. We'll talk on this issue at maybe at home. Dr. Duvall,
yes.
I found your presentation. I completely agreed. You seemed to hit all the good points. You didn't mention incentivizing. In other words, paying for completion, planning the universities, making the universities incentivize graduating students in 3 years, 4 years, not 6 years, and also for the students some way to incentivize their opportunity grant if they complete. Could you comment on that?
Yes, but very carefully. thank you for the question, Representative Huizan. It's, as you know, incentives can have unexpected consequences in how it's implemented and how it's applied. I think that my experience with institutions, 2 and 4 year, is that they are very keen on getting students to completion. In the program that I worked in, which was just a doctoral program, we like to brag about how many students that started our program finished that program. So I think everyone is keen on reaching that kind of goal of 100% completion. On the other hand, it's important to recognize that students come with a lot of issues these days that make it difficult sometimes for them to finish a degree and to finish it quickly. The cliche is life happens, you know, and I think that has to be recognized too. Any incentive program that we can think up, there are people who will find ways of implementing that to their advantage and to, at the same time, to the advantage of students. It's something that we need to consider and work carefully on, I believe, but at the same time recognize that the perfect incentive program, at least as far as I'm knowledgeable of them, that has not yet been invented.
Real quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Redmond High School just came out. Their graduation rate was very low for the four years, but their 5 year, because the students were staying in university or in high school to take college courses. Is your council committee looking at, you know, encouraging more of that at the high school level and having universities accept those?
Yes. Our meeting in March will look at the coordination between high school and college, and I think that's one of the programs actually that we're looking at, and some others too. I think that if we can get students, let me back up just a minute. If students have are first time college students, if no one in their family has ever been to college, how you get into college is a mystery. And if we can help students see the path through the door of the college and come with some understanding of how to navigate that, then I think we can see better transitions between high schools and colleges. And that's not just having courses with advanced credit. That's part of it. But it's also knowing how you pay for this, what weird words like matriculation mean, and the thing I've been touting lately is something that we used to call orientation. Now we don't want to call it that anymore, but something about introduction to college and how you study and where you go to get help and who can help you fill out that financial aid form, you know, those kinds of things that are important to beginning college success, where people just don't throw up their hands and say, I'm out of here. Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Duvall. Vice Chair Harker, you had a question about the portal.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bryant, in the letter here, you mentioned the portal is being developed, creating a portal for all accredited campus-based and online courses. This is in process. Is that something that the HEC has delegated responsibility to someone else for? Has Department of Ed taken it on, or where is that going? Who's going to do
the
it?
The legislature. Chair Devereaux and Vice Chair Harker. The legislature designated the Office of Degree Authorization to do that, and in September they went to the Emergency Board and got some additional funding to pursue the design of that. So it's that group that's in charge of it, and under our wings of authority, the ODA is the only tangible agency that we have right now that we're supposed to oversee. So that's why it's mentioned there, and the whole committee thought it's important to pursue it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so we talked about that when we discussed Rep. Johnson's and my bills regarding transparency of programs, et cetera, that probably, you know, the place to make this all available to students and their parents is going to be through this portal that ODA is working on.
I wanted to be sure we weren't going in progress.
No, I think it's all the same. Yeah. So before we leave Western Governors, I just want to make a couple of comments. You may not realize that Western Governors was first created by a group of governors, hence mm-hmm. the name, the Western Governors, back in the mid-90s or late 90s, and including our own current governor during his first phase. Governor Kitzhaber was involved in that. It is a nonprofit university. It is, Vice Chair Bryant mentioned, you know, it's really addressing a kind of niche market. You know, there are certain students, generally older students who've already completed community college. Very often they're working students for whom this kind of proficiency-based education seems to work. They are not, their students are not currently eligible for the opportunity grant. And the reason for that is, to be eligible for the, to have students eligible for the opportunity grant, an institution has to meet two criteria. One is that they have to be nonprofit, and the second is that they have to be based in Oregon or have an Oregon physical presence. Western Governors is nonprofit. It's a not-for-profit, but it does not, you know, unlike Washington's WGU, it doesn't have a campus here in Oregon. So, you know, if Western Governors did decide to create a campus in Oregon, then they would automatically be eligible for the opportunity grant. So that is something they can do. You know, at this point, they're still kind of building themselves up in Oregon, I think, as Mr. Bryant said. So, you know, we'll see. I approve of this wait-and-see kind of approach. Western Governors is still relatively new, and so, you know, although it has met its accreditation requirements, you know, its track record is still a relatively brief one, so you know we'll see how it goes. Okay, can we move on to the next topic then?
Let me talk next about the report on textbook affordability. I think the concept we all have textbooks is faculty member chooses it, the publisher publishes it. End of story. Not actually the case so much anymore. One of the issues, of course, is how those textbooks are chosen and how the publisher bundles materials for the textbook. The other complaints include things like, I bought this $200 textbook and they only used the first 50 pages. So there have been a lot of concern voiced by students and by students' parents about costs of textbooks and how they're selected and how they're used. This is one place where I think technology is probably coming to our rescue. as increasingly there are open source initiatives where materials that are common to courses wherever they are offered are placed in the cloud. Now I'm talking about something I don't understand. And readily available, free of charge to any individual. It doesn't matter that the publisher is publishing a $200 textbook with an including a CD, or that the teacher chooses only 50 pages of the textbook to use. Washington State is one place we have looked at where there was a funded project that helped develop this. There is increasingly private funds going into investigating this. This probably won't be the whole question, and there will always be students who want the hard copy and who want to use it forever in their career and so on. But I think that is increasingly going to be one of the things we rely on. There are other processes that are recommended from the textbook work group that encourage colleges to pay attention to mundane things like how quickly textbooks are ordered and are available, because that can help reduce the price. Whether or not textbooks can be resold, what kinds of changes and revisions are made from one edition to the next. There are also, institutions can put emphasis on a wide variety of materials that can be available and used through materials that are available on the web, materials that are available from textbooks, materials that are supplemental and available in libraries and online libraries. So this report is not an end-all, be-all answer to the problem, but I think it points to some directions and will continue to be studied. If I might, Chair Dimrow, let me also speak about credit for prior learning and then ask questions or entertain questions about that. Credit for prior learning is not something that's particularly new. It's been around for a while, and people have been able to do testing to test out of courses. They have brought coursework they did in military, a lot of different sources of learning that they can bring that will either garner full or complete credit for a course that they are testing out of. Credit for prior learning is really readily available in community colleges. It's readily available in universities and public, both public and private. Again, Merrill Hurst has been very involved with this and very much a leader in that. But this is something that is changing pretty rapidly too. And one of the assignments was to form an advisory committee that would continue to study this, and that has been done, and they are regularly meeting. So this report is not an end report, but simply paints the picture of where we're going and how we're going to continue to study that. And as Vice Chair Bryant indicated, that's true for all of these reports. You gave us three assignments that were very difficult as we got into them and very far-reaching as we investigated them, and that we will need to continue to study. So if there are questions on these two or further questions, we would be happy to try to answer those.
I might add on the credit for prior learning, there's many people who've got enough credits from a variety of sources over the years, but they've never put it all together. And so part of the idea is that can help us with 40-40-20, and they should have a degree, but where does it come from, and how do you pull that together? That also goes to your question, but it should happen. There should be a way to do that. They've done the work.
And community colleges are energetically investigating this right now to encourage students who maybe transferred onto the baccalaureate degree, maybe with enough courses for an associate degree, or maybe lacking one or two, to come back, get that degree, and have that credential on their resume.
Thank you. Rep. Davis.
Yeah, I just have a question about the books. To what degree are the bookstores a major revenue source for the universities?
I don't have a definitive answer to that, but I do appreciate the question you're asking, Representative Gallegos. It's, I think, in some colleges, it's an auxiliary enterprise within the institution, and they do provide some revenue back to the institution. In other instances, they may be privately owned, Barnes & Noble kind of stores that are just housed on the institution. I think it varies a lot, and I don't have an answer how many are this kind, how many are that, or the kind of money that is brought back into the institution.
Their intent is not to operate at a loss, though. So
sure.
That's
I think
right.
The goal is to have some profit and additional revenue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can speak to Portland Community College's experience there. The bookstore is part of the college, but it's considered an auxiliary service of the college. And it does raise revenue, and most of the revenue actually goes to support other auxiliary services like food services, which always runs at a deficit, and, you know, for whatever reason. And so it is somewhat of a challenge for the college as more and more students are switching to buying used copies or using the internet to get books from Amazon or whatever. You know, where often you can get them at a fraction of the cost. And that's why, you know, the publishers have a sort of business interest in continually redoing their textbooks. So you'll have new editions coming out, if not every year, at least every other year, with only really cosmetic changes for the most part, so that students can't, you know, buy a used copy at a much lower rate. So, you know, there's this challenge going on.
At the same time, I think the college bookstore is like your local independent bookstore that you visit. A lot of the money that they make is not on textbooks. It's on T-shirts and, you know, coffee mugs and...
Mm-hmm. Computers a lot.
And computers.
Now, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a follow-up observation. You know, I mean, it's really clear to me, I think, in the last few years of teaching that... more and more teachers, more and more students simply wouldn't buy the books, and they were, you know, sharing them with other classmates, or they simply weren't reading.
Yeah. They have become very expensive, there's no doubt about it. And for community college students, the textbooks might be more expensive than the tuition, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Going back to the prior learning assessments, so, you know, when we... when we charge you with this issue, you know, it was our concerns really were twofold. One, how can we make this more available to students who could benefit from prior learning assessments, getting credit that way, but also how we can be sure that, you know, the quality is there, right? That schools are not simply awarding prior credit in order to, you know, increase their achievement compacts, you know, to meet their goals. So, you know, I know that there are some outside agencies that are validating prior learning, or I don't know. How did that figure into the conversation, Betty?
You may need to help me out here, Neil, but I think there's recognition of agencies like CAEL, Council for Experience. I say, yeah. I was on that board for a long time. I have to stop and think. And it's always a part of regional accreditation, which I have some experience with, too. And I don't think there's any guarantee, but if the question that was raised earlier about proficiency, and I think the student must prove proficiency, and I think that's a primary measure of the quality of the experience, not how it was delivered, but do they have this proficiency? Would you add anything to that, Neil?
Well, and the larger schools and probably the regionals also are so protective of the quality of their degree. There's an internal review where if you're asking for credit from this particular community college, it's they review it carefully. And I remember one example where Southern Oregon, if you went to this community college and they had a good music program, they give you credit. But if you went to this other community college, they had a lousy music program, they wouldn't give you any credit for it. You had to start over again. So that would be helpful for the portal to show that up. But my experience with professors and deans is they're very protective of their labels, so maybe sometimes too protective.
Great. Okay. Colleagues, any further questions?
No, thanks.
Well, thank you very much for coming
it's a pleasure
here.
Talking to you this morning.
You know, when the HEC was first set up, and I came, Rep. Johnson and I first, came and met with you. We expressed our appreciation, but we also told you that the prime requirement for this job is patience and flexibility, because the HEC is an evolving entity. And I promise you that it will continue to evolve over the course of this legislative session. So I look forward to working with you as we're kind of looking at the larger organizational changes that we're going to be wrestling with this session. We're really going to need your advice and expertise. So.
And we'll be patient.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Okay, colleagues, Friday is our governance day. You can look forward to Rep. Johnson and my digging into the recommendations from the Joint Special Committee. We're going to spend a chunk of time doing that. So if you could take a look at that in advance of the meeting, that would be great. We're also going to be hearing a couple of other bills, having work sessions on a couple of, no, I'm sorry, public hearings on a couple of bills, and one work session as well. Oh, yeah, we're going to have a work session on that 529 bill, remember, that we talked about the first week. So if you could reconsider, take another look at that. That was the bill that requires the, when a newborn is, somebody is born, that the parents are notified about the 529 plan. So
what are the materials do I find in the joint special report?
So I think it's online.
Is it
on
OLIS? Is it on OLIS?
Yeah, and I think I sent it in a separate email to all of you last week as well. So if you go through your email, you should be able to find it. Like Thursday, Wednesday or Thursday of last week. Okay. Yes, Rep. Johnson, you had a...
Mr. Chair, is it your intent then on Friday to kind of lead the committee through the various portions of the bill, if you were, that came out of the work group, so we can identify kind of section by section and kind of help the committee work their way through that?
Yes, with your assistance.
Yeah, but recognizing that the total bill itself is what? How many pages?
197.
Of which about three actually have new content. So if we could just maybe have that available for members to work through the relevant portions rather than the stuff that doesn't really apply.
It's really just the first 10 pages,
exactly,
actually.
So.
But also, I think what makes, and certainly you'll have that available, but I think what's even more useful is the summary that Victoria did,
and the
actual report, which takes a look at it section by section. So.
Thank you.
Okay, colleagues, with that, we are adjourned. Okay.